It is being hailed as the world's largest free trade deal in history. It encompasses 15 nations across the Asia-Pacific region, including Australia, China, Indonesia, Japan, and South Korea, which, incidentally, sees the five nations just mentioned also being members of the G20, making the new Asia-Pacific trade deal an exciting prospect for that bloc. Now, labeled as the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, or the RCEP, the Mega Free Trade Pact came into place just recently, allowing the member nations to enjoy multiple advantages, including the reduction of tariffs, simplified customs agreements, and a reduction in trade costs, to name a few. Well, the agreement appears to have some common traits with other existing global trade deals. For example, in the case of the EU, with the free movement of people being a key aspect, which for some could see many people in member nations being given new opportunities, hence lifting them out of poverty.
Information age, digitalization, they can learn from each other's experiences, and the people-to-people movement will be very freely movement like EU. So this kind of agreements always bring fruitful results for the local people, the poverty alleviation, the joining technology transfers.
Hello, welcome to Economic Divide with me, Kavit Tafwai. In this week's show, we'll be taking a deeper look into the signing of the RCEP and ascertain just how it may benefit various countries who have become members and examine just how big of an impact the RCEP will have on the global economy. Now, just as a point of note, following our exclusive story that was covered right here on Economic Divide surrounding the Air Canada scandal. So, just how big a deal is the RCEP? For starters, the negotiations over the agreement have taken 8 years, and now that it has been signed and sealed, the member nations of the RCEP account for one-third of the world's population, and more importantly, some 29% of the total world GDP, making the RCEP larger than the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreements and the European Union. The impact of the RCEP is likely to have on the global economy, well, it is also a highlight of the pact, with the Peterson Institute for International Economics stating that the deal could see an increase in global national income of around $186 billion, NC member states have their GDPs increased by at least 0.2%. The pact could have been a lot bigger, in fact, incorporating half the world's population. For example, in this case, we're referring to India. India, with its 1.35 billion people and huge economy. Well, it was also part of that plan, yet India pulled out at the 11th hour as it felt that by signing the deal, it would see its own economy and industry suffer. However, the door has been left open for India to join at any time in the future.
The Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, or the RCEP, is the world's largest free trade deal and has taken 8 years to formulate. With 15 member nations, including five of which are in the G20, the partnership is set to allow member nations to trade together on a more fluid basis and hopefully allow the region to expand economically together. Traditionally, the Asian-Pacific area has enjoyed similar trade deals in the past, but with multilateralism becoming an ever more popular concept around the world in an attempt to break current hegemonies, the notion of global cooperation has some interesting advantages. Already, the European Union is an example of a successful regional trade pact, and there are numerous others around the world. So how then does the RCEP compare with such agreements? Are there any similarities, and are there any differences?
Yeah, obviously, there are some overlaps between this new agreement and other existing agreements, such as the Asian Free Trade and others. But as we understand, there are also some bigger differences between this new one and the existing ones. For example, there have been new countries who joined the agreement. In addition to Asian countries, we have New Zealand and Australia as new members. And this will bring together a bigger force to promote free regional trade.
With the introduction of new countries into the deal, with the likes of New Zealand and Australia now being part of the RCEP, there's now a very good opportunity to demonstrate that regional cooperation could be a perfect tool to promote development and trade. What now remains to be seen is whether the nations aligned to the RCEP can overcome political differences and concentrate on trade to bolster economies, all looking to emerge from the impact of the coronavirus that's done so much damage around the world.
How did benefits of being a member of the RCEP convert into numbers? Well, for smaller nations, the impact is immediate, with the likes of Vietnam seeing their GDP rising anything between 2 and 4%, which for Vietnam is a significant increase, which will no doubt be emulated by other smaller economy members. The market scale of the RCEP is also interesting when put into numbers. As we have already mentioned, the deal results in about 29% of the world GDP, which is some $26.2 trillion, and equates to a sum of 32.5% of global investment. The advantages are also truly regional, as most of the trade between Asia-Pacific nations is conducted within the area. Examples of this are the $532.6 billion per year that Australia enjoys with the region, and for New Zealand, it accounts for 56% of the country's exports, providing 61% of the total foreign investment into the country, again, proving that the RCEP will be most fruitful.
There's no doubt that as the world's second largest economy and rising fast, China firmly has its eyes set on the top spot in the world, with many suggesting that China overtaking the US at the top of the economic ladder is not a case of if, but when. For some, the RCEP has been criticised as it will more than likely benefit China more than other signatory members. With China being the economic powerhouse behind the agreement, it seems that China in particular has a lot to gain by having 14 other free trade partners at its disposal. The economic expansion sought by China and demonstrated through the likes of the One Belt, One Road initiative are clear examples of how China is using trade to expand its footprint around the world. And as we deal with trade wars, COVID-19 and economic uncertainty, the RCEP is an example of China's multilateral adaptability to its economic roadmap.
Well, I think speaking of China, we need to think about, we need to put this against the general background of Chinese economic strategy. China has been promoting very hard its very ambitious One Belt and One Road project across the globe. And it comes at a very interesting time. We are now in the middle of a global pandemic. We are also seeing an escalating tension in China and the US and also some regional countries. So I think this is something that will be supplementing China's One Belt, One Road project.
However, not 1 month into the agreement, and already small economic skirmishes have started to occur, in particular between Australia and China, where China has imposed tariffs on Australian wine, as well as seeing diplomatic tension rise over the abuse of civilians by the Australian military in Afghanistan, something that China has highly condemned. On a wider scale, tension between the US and the Chinese has also led to a war of words and trade between Washington and Beijing. However, with the tide set to turn in the US with the election of Joe Biden as president, a new government in the White House may see Biden's multilateral form of diplomacy reach out to China and once again see ties restored, fixing the damage committed by Donald Trump.
I'm pleased to say that joining me in the studio today is Martin Lockett, professor of strategic management from Nottingham University Business School, China. Currently based in Ningbo, Professor Lockett has over 40 years' experience in Chinese culture, economy, management, and development, and has worked on multiple consultancy projects and education programs in China. Professor, many thanks for joining us here on Economic Divide.
It's very good to be with you.
So first up, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, RCEP, a huge project, as you're well aware, and it has been labeled as the world's largest free trade agreement, 8 years in the making. How important do you think this deal is, and how will this spark the regional economy off in the post-pandemic era?
We are absolutely right that this is one of the world's largest free trade agreements, if not the largest. It's going to cover 15 countries with about 30% of the world's population and 30% of the world's economy. That includes China, Japan, South Korea, the 10 Asian countries, Australia and New Zealand. So it's going to make much of Asia-Pacific into a free trade zone. It's going to be a bit like the European Union or the North America in that respect. So it's been estimated over time that it will have a very big impact. One from some professors at Johns Hopkins University in the US estimates a positive impact of $186 billion in terms of global income. However, that's only really 0.2% of the world economy, so it's still limited in that respect.
Okay, well, you got five members of the RCEP who are in the G20. How do you think the trade deal will benefit the larger economies in the region? For one, many are stating already that the big winner in this deal is China. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, clearly China's going to be a winner. It's going to help overall economic development in all the countries. So in that sense, you've got 15 winners. Actually, the losers are going to be probably the US and India. Now, that's not so much that they're going to get real damage to their economies from this, but they're going to lose opportunities. So one estimate about India was it might have a small economic damage from the impact of the free trade zone elsewhere, but it's going to lose opportunities compared with if it took part. So from that viewpoint, it's the what we sometimes call opportunity costs that are the big ones for those who are not taking part, and benefits for all those taking part. If we look politically, then I think it can be seen as a demonstration of multilateralism in practice by China. And I think that's where possibly the biggest benefit to China lies, in its showing a commitment to multilateralism.
And finally, the legacy left by Donald Trump saw China and the U.S. fall into a bitter trade war that may or may not improve under the new administration. Will then a deal as big as the RCEP spark a wider global battle as the likes of the U.S. and the EU attempt to compete with such a deal, or they solely have to accept that multilateralism is the way forward and adapt accordingly?
Well, I think the EU and USA will accept this deal. I think it's likely that the new U.S. administration, led by the soon-to-be President Biden, will adopt a more multilateral approach and will look at how it can extend those agreements and maybe get back into some that it's left under President Trump. I mean, I think the U.S. could potentially seek to extend the RCEP to bring back its previous idea of something called the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership, CPTPP. It's a little bit of a mouthful, but that was essentially a rather wider agreement that also involved the U.S. So for now, I think we see three big trading blocks, the EU, the Americas, and RCEP, and then outside it, some countries like India and potentially the UK after Brexit.
Okay, thank you so much. Thanks there to Professor Martin Lockett from Nottingham University Business School, China. Great hearing your thoughts and information. Many thanks for being with us on the show.
Thank you.
Okay, lots of interesting ideas there. Of course, we still have to wait for Joe Biden, the president-elect, to be confirmed. All right, we're about to take a short break here on Economic Divide, but don't go anywhere as we have plenty more coming up after the break. We'll be joined by our regular researcher and journalist, Atifa Padidar, as she runs us through some of the stories hitting social media pages surrounding the RCEP. Also look at how smaller economies will benefit or lose out from joining the RCEP, as well as taking a look at how other global trade agreements will react to the creation of the RCEP. Also, a deeper look at the impact of the COVID-19 virus on the Asia-Pacific economy in our in-depth section. Time now for our in-depth section. Much like the rest of the world, the COVID-19 virus has had a heavy impact on the economies of the nations in the Asia-Pacific region. A report by Oxford Economics highlights this, that this region is going to be recovering the fastest once the pandemic subsides. Now, we move on to the next report, and our in-depth look comes from the World Bank, and what it states is that global GDPs will contract on average at a rate of 2.8% for 2020, growing to around 6% in 2021. Yet for China, well, that's going to benefit. 9% is what is going to rise in terms of GDP, in part assisted by the extra trade generated from the signing of the RCEP. And finally, when compared to the rest of the world, one of the main issues will be the time that it takes to recover. And much like an injury on a person, this depends on the depth of the scar. For example, looking here for the UK, it saw its economy fall by nearly 25% during the peak of the pandemic. Yet South Korea, for example, a member of the RCEP, saw its economy shrink by only 7.6%, far lower than the global average of 12 to 14%. Let's now take a look at how smaller Asia-Pacific economies will benefit or not from the new RCEP deal in our next report.
We've already discussed the notion that China and other larger economies will benefit from the RCEP, but what then of the smaller economies in the pact? With the likes of Brunei, Vietnam, Thailand, and others in the agreement, as well as larger economies such as Malaysia, Indonesia, Australia, and New Zealand, the pot is well mixed in nations and economy sizes joining together, raising the question as to just what benefits the smaller nations may see from being a member of the RCEP.
From my understanding, I think there will be some impact, in terms of positive impact, it may be very limited. Because if you look at the history of these countries trading with each other within the bloc, I think they have already enjoyed a very high level of free trade with each other. So with the new countries joining the club, if we are looking at China as the biggest player in the region, I'm not sure how these countries will be able to benefit.
So is the RCEP then just a rewording of existing agreements in place? And if so, how can smaller nations adapt a deal to suit their needs? The benefits of the RCEP will be bespoke to each member state. Yet for Vietnam, for example, figures suggest that the GDP of the country could rise by as much as 4%, which could play a significant part in the future economy of the nation.
We need to sign this moment to reform our economy so that we can soon bounce back and assert our central position in world economy.
But lower down the scale, when it comes to the predictions of how the RCEP will benefit nations, is a much smaller growth rate. Although the RCEP area is huge when combined, some of the smaller nations could only see a 0.2% growth in their GDP, which makes one question the benefits of joining such a scheme. However, one must also acknowledge the notion of regional cooperation and solidarity. As to when it comes to trade, diplomacy and politics, there's no more important entity than one's own neighbours. And when push comes to shove, knowing they're there is a comforting feeling.
Time now to bring in researcher and journalist Adafe Paridar to tell us more about the RCEP. Welcome. So tell us what you got for us for this, I guess, the biggest trading bloc in the world.
So let's see what I picked. The first one is from Peter Draper, and he is talking about a piece which talks about this trade pact is one small geo-economic step or a giant eastward leap in a geostrategic gravity. This guy is obviously talking about with this trade pact, we're going to witness a shift of power from west to east. Something to think about. Let's go to the next tweet.
Sure. Let's see what this one is.
This one, Dr. Rizwan is saying, RCEP will help recover members from pandemic losses at rapid pace. Well, this is one of the hopes that members of this pact are signing the agreement because of this, because China obviously is recovering faster than others, and it can help other members of the pact to recover more rapidly. Our final tweet is from someone who is against this trade pact. Harshaw says, it was foolish to enter into RCEP with non-market economy with so much state enterprises. China market economy stance is namesake, which one should not fall trap into. Well, this guy is obviously a pro-West and anti-China. They're saying that China is just entering into this agreement for the sake of China, and it's not going to help others.
Very well, thank you very much for that. I don't have much more to add to that. Thank you for that, Atafa Bayadar, researcher and journalist. Okay, in our final report, we're going to take a look at how the RCEP compares to other great trade deal giants, in particular, focusing on the EU and the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. So stay tuned.
It seems that the world has phased in and out of trade agreements from the moment the concept was invented. The likes of NAFTA was quashed by Donald Trump, which resulted in the birth of the US-Mexico-Canada deal, and the EEC was reborn into the EU in Europe, showing that flexibility and change are important parts of trade deals as they adapt to varying circumstances around the world. With the RCEP, it seems that the agreement, whilst on paper sounds very promising, could show signs of weaknesses like other pacts that have been and gone before them. Could then other trade agreements around the world emulate the examples set by the RCEP? And if so, just how?
I think in terms of the general direction of this agreement is something that this is something that the other parts of the world can probably learn from. But in terms of the actual impact, I think it still needs to be rigorously assessed to see how it actually bring positive impact to these member countries.
So why then do trade agreements collapse? In theory, the signing of a deal which can boost an economy should be a win-win situation for all parties concerned. Yet when we look back at trade agreements of the past, and even the ones that are still in play, one of the major challenges to maintaining an agreement is the political differences between nations. Take, for example, the case of the EU. The varying cultures and political views in Europe is as wide as the spectrum can allow, and is hence why the UK, for example, broke away from the EU. Yet as we all know, and have seen, the devastating economic cost of Britain appears to be far greater than the benefits of leaving the bloc over political differences. The same can be said of the NAFTA agreement, which saw Trump pull out of, citing a bad deal. This is another example of how differences in political thought have changed the shape of trade deals that were actually quite successful in the first place. For the RCEP, only time will tell whether it stands the test of time and political opinion. But from an optimistic point of view, the notion of multilateralism is a concept that should be embraced. And if the world starts to see super trade deals emerging, for example, between the EU and the RCEP, then the future may look very bright for the global economy and trade.
As the world emerges from one of the most devastating impacts to human life, as well as the economy, so too does it seem that the world is looking forward to a new political agenda, as the notion of multilateralism appears to be a common denominator as countries bind together to create pockets of economic powerhouses around the world. With the EU, US, MIX, CAN, and now the RCEP all being fine examples of how economies can work together towards a mutually beneficial system, the winds of change are starting to blow as the likes of China, South Korea, and Japan work their way up the economic ladder, threatening the position of the US and showing that the self-centered approach led by Donald Trump is a dated and ineffective way of building an economy. What now remains to be seen is whether the creation of the RCEP as a global competitor to the likes of the EU may spark in the future a super trade deal pact, merging together the likes of the RCEP and the EU, creating a multilateral pact never seen before. Well, a lot remains to be done, but the future may just hold such a story. That's about all the time we have for this episode. On behalf of myself, Kavit Thakwe, and the whole team here on Economic Divide, stay safe, and we'll see you again next time.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Wassalatu wassalamu ala sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome once again to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge. We are, as you are aware, discussing about the qualities of the pious people. We reached this particular phrase in the sermon number 184 in Nahj al-Balagha, where Imam Ali alayhi salam explains to us that one of the qualities of those who are pious is that state of humility of their hearts. A person who is pious is one whose heart is humble, and his internal, his inherent state, his soul is filled with the majesty of God, and therefore he is in a state of humility. That awareness about God is there, that contemplation and that remembrance of God in different states of his life is there, and this leads to that state of humility of the heart. And Imam Ali alayhi salam says that in this particular phrase, tarahu khashi'an qalbuh, you will see that his heart is humble. Of course, those who are humble, the signs of that humility of the heart is seen in their obedience, in their adherence to the sharia. It is seen in different occasions of how they pray to their Lord and how they submit to the greatness of His Majesty.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, one of the narrations where Imam Ali alayhi salam or the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam explained to us about the state of a believer, about the pious person, is this particular narration. In one of the sermons, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, خَاشِعًا لِلَّهِ عَزَّ وَجَلْ, that a person who is pious, normally a good person, a person who is pious especially, is one who is humble towards his Lord, the Majestic. يُرَاوِحُ بَيْنَ الْوَجْهِ وَالْكَفَّيْنِ, that humility that is inside him is expressed in this sense, that he is in the state of prostration and in the state of supplication by raising his hands. And you hear the, it's a beautiful expression that Imam uses. يُرَاوِحُ بَيْنَ الْوَجْهِ وَالْكَفَّيْنِ means when he is tired of prostrating, he sits up and he raises his hands towards supplication. When he is tired of raising his hands in supplication, he goes back to prostration. And this is the way he shows his humility towards his Lord. خُشُوعٌ فِي السِّرِّ لِرَبِّهِ لَدَمْعُهُ صَبِيبٌ وَلَقَلْبُهُ Wajib. We see that he is in that state of khushu', he is in the state of humility. Inside his heart, that humility is there. His tears are flowing, and his heart is in a state of, you can say, is in a state of worry. He's always worried about his actions, about what he's supposed to do, about his duties. So, we see that a person who wants to achieve piety, this is the state of humility that he needs to be in. And one of the ways this humility is expressed, of course, it is in the state of prayer. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Quran, amongst the qualities of the believers is that fi salatihim khashi'un, that they are humble in their prayer. When they pray to the Lord, they are humble. We have narrations that Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam, our fourth holy Imam, the son of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, when he would stand up to pray, we are told that he would be firm and unwavering like a tree, like a firm tree, such that when you would see him, he would be so much engrossed in the prayer that he would not move around, and he would be concentrating. Of course, he would be trembling in the fear of God, but he would be firm. And only if the wind would blow, then you would see that his clothes are moving. That's how he was in the state of worshipping God.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, in the previous segment, we say that worshipping God has to be expressed in the way we worship. And that is why Imam Ali alayhi salam says to Kumail in one of the narrations, reportedly, لَيْسَ الشَّأْنُ أَن تُصَلِّي وَتَصُومُ وَتَتَصَدَّقُ الشَّأْنُ أَن تَكُونَ الصَّلَاةُ أَن تَكُونَ الصَّلَاةُ فَعَلْتَ بِقَلْبٍ تَقِيٍّ. I mean, Imam Ali is saying the reality of worship is not prayer and fasting and giving, charity. Rather, the true worship is that when you pray or you fast or whatever you do, فَعَلْتَ بِقَلْبٍ تَقِي, you do it with a heart that is fearing God. وَعَمَلٍ عِنْدَ اللَّهِ مَرْضِي, and that action should be for the pleasure of God. وَخُشُوعٍ سَوِي, it should be as a result of that humility and humbleness towards God. Here, don't mistake me, Imam alayhi salam is not trying to reduce the value of praying and fasting and giving charity. These are obligations that are supposed to be followed. But Imam alayhi salam is trying to emphasize on the soul and the reality of these acts of worship. And that is that state of humility within. So a person needs to build up that humility within so that these apparent actions get life. Otherwise, they're just apparent forms without real life. A person should slowly and gradually work to achieve that state of humility. Let us pray to Allah that He gives us the opportunity to achieve humility so that we can be counted amongst those who are pious. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد ممجد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان العين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Salaamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. And welcome to the program of Islamic Upbringing here on IRIB English Radio. In this program, we discuss the problems and questions the parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. And the answers are mostly based upon the book, Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. We have in the studio our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad. He's an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmi Aqum. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program, Brother Miqdad.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
Brother Miqdad, one of our listeners, they're having a question. Let me read it out for you. It says that I'm going to be a mentor at an Islamic camp for 10-year-olds. Could you give me some tips on how to have positive effects on these Muslim children? What do you have to say about it, brother?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. There's a lot to be said regarding mentors and perhaps requires a much more detailed discussion. But just a couple of points that come to mind right now. The role of mentors for children is extremely, extremely influential. Uh-huh. Little children, especially children that are at the age of 9, 10, 11, they really look up to their mentors, mm-hmm. People that they spend time with, especially in places like Islamic camps. And this is just a reminder for our communities to make sure that they actually strengthen these courses, these camps that happen perhaps throughout the year or mostly in summer, mm-hmm. Where children get together and go to a place, a particular place, where whether it's a weekend or a week or 2 weeks, yeah. And they spend time with mentors and teachers, learning about different things at the same time, doing sports and activities, mm-hmm. and away from the family, basically. Yeah. These are very, very impactful in the life of a young child. Mm-hmm. And the role of mentors in that is extremely, extremely powerful, and we need to be very careful. So first and foremost is really to pray to Allah and ask Allah's help for this, because any impact that you will have on this will actually be very impactful. It's not something that we can take lightly. Uh-huh. So inshallah, we pray to Allah, we go into this camp with a lot of sincerity, with a lot of dua, a lot of tawassul to the Ahlul Bayt, that Allah can help us basically to make sure that we have the right impact on these children. So inshallah, through sincerity, we can achieve a lot. Second point is to keep in mind that children will learn more from what they see than what they hear. Uh-huh. So the way we behave, not just in relation to children, but generally the way we mm-hmm. behave is often more impactful than what we teach them through our words. Mm-hmm. And so as a mentor, it's very important to always be careful of our actions. That so how you behave.
Children learn from their elders.
Exactly. They learn when they see. If you want to teach a child, for example, to pray on time, uh-huh. right? There's one way we can have a whole class about the importance of praying on time, mm-hmm. etc. But there's a better way, is to actually be there on time for namaz.
Yeah, that's right.
For you're playing football, having loads of fun, adhan's coming, you stop the game and say, mm-hmm. I'm going to pray, it's time for prayers. Children will follow because yeah. they have respect for you. And so this is very crucial, that we need to show in our actions that what we want to teach them. So basically, mm-hmm. preach by actions.
So basically, actions create a lot of impact on children.
Definitely. Another point is to build a very strong relationship with your mentees. Mm-hmm. The more, the closer this relationship, the closer the impact, the stronger the impact will be. Mm-hmm. Now, this relationship is built through a lot of respect, a lot of discussion, friendly discussions, but also doing things with them. So whether it's playing sports with them, whether it's sitting down and having dinner and lunch with them. Basically, as a mentor, you should be with them throughout the adventures that they go through. Even though sometimes if it means that something you've never done in your life, and you might even be weak at it. For example, remember we had mentors that have never played football in their lives, right? Uh-huh. But just for the sake of the camp, it's okay, put some shoes on and put some tracksuit bottoms on and play football, even though you don't know how to kick a ball. And it's okay if you get laughed a little bit. It shows that you're part with the camp, basically.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Brother Miqdad. And to your listeners, we'll be right back after a short break.
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
So welcome back to your audience, and we're discussing about how to create a relationship with children. So Brother Miqdad, please continue.
So the more closer our relationship, the more we become a role model for children, right? Uh-huh. Because children actually count you as amongst them, but at the same time, successful, at the same time older, at the same time better than them. So they actually count you as a kind of a role model. And this is a very important place, because then they look at everything you do as well.
Yeah.
It's interesting, once a scholar was saying that between the Dhuhr namaz and the Asr namaz, he removed his watch whilst he was praying because he was sweating, it was really hot.
Uh-huh.
After the Asr salah, he realized that everybody else has taken their watch out.
Yeah.
Because they were just copying, you see. They were looking exactly what the scholar is doing, and they were following exactly what he was doing. So this is how we become.
So actions do really matter.
Definitely. So we need to be careful, basically. So that requires us to be careful what we do. One important thing is to realize that when we become role models, always try to then be an intermediary for the real role models. Because we've talked about many times that the real models are the Ahlul Bayt for us, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so when you become a role model, your duty is to actually say, you know what, I'm a role model, but I'm just an intermediary for you to take the Ahlul Bayt as role models.
Uh-huh.
So if you like something in me, always attribute it back to the Ahlul Bayt, right? So what they realize that this person is my role model, is doing this. I like him a lot. He's doing this. But he's told me that this is what the Ahlul Bayt used to do.
Yeah.
And so actually, they actually fall in love with the Ahlul Bayt ultimately.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Another point to consider, to be careful of is, when it comes to difficulties that will come in the course, whether it's through events that are, for example, there was a mistake done, or for example, there was a fight, or for example, you wanted children to pray on time, but they weren't praying on time, or correcting things. We need to be careful, because obviously the role of the mentor is to make sure the camp runs very smoothly and that there's no issues, and when there is issue, to try and solve them.
Yeah.
We should be very careful as mentors to ensure that we give reminders at the right time, and we do something called taghaful at the right time as well.
Uh-huh.
A lot of the issues can be solved through ignoring, especially when times when children have realized their mistake. You know, for example, let's say they had a fight between themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there was a fight, maybe a bit of tears, things got broken, for example. At times, you can just ignore it, or very indirect reminder. Right?
Yeah.
Because they know themselves the mistake, right? To go and point out the finger, you did this bad thing and you did that bad thing, you shouldn't have done this, what lesson do you learn from this? It's actually aggravating the situation, right? Now, it was unnecessary to do that. We knew our mistake, just ignore it. And when you ignore it, what happens is that children actually, their self-respect remains, basically. They don't feel embarrassed, because once you point them out, say, you made this mistake, now they count themselves as, you know what, my my role model that I had as a role model now counts me very less. He doesn't respect me anymore.
Yeah.
My self-image has been tampered. And this actually will hamper and make it more difficult for you to work with them. So many a times, it's important to do tarafut, to ignore it. And when we do give reminders, we should be careful when do we give reminders and what kind of reminders we give.
Thank you so much, Brother Maghdad. And dear audience, thank you so much for staying with us. Do not go anywhere because we'll be right back after a short break.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم said, He who has a child must treat him in a childish manner.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
So welcome back, dear audience, and we were discussing about how a person can be a good mentor for children. So, Brother Maghdad, I would like you to continue.
Well, we give reminders, always stick to reminders that are related to wajib and haram. Don't go into things that are mustahab, for example, or makruh, for example. Stick to, I'm talking about Islamic reminders, right?
Yeah.
Stick to things that are wajib and haram, and be as less harsh as possible. Remember, tarbiyah or having impact on children is an internal impact, right? Mm-hmm. You don't want them to adopt a certain action only for the period of the course. Mm-hmm. That's a pointless goal.
Yeah.
For example, you want to teach them to pray on time,
mm-hmm.
right? There's one way we can have loads of rewards for those who pray on time during the next week, for example. The mm-hmm. course is a one-week course. The person who prays on time throughout the 7 days will get this reward, and if you don't pray on time, you'll get this punishment.
Yeah.
Now, what this will do is it will only make them change for 7 days. After uh-huh. that, when they go back home, they'll be the same.
Yeah.
Right? They won't change anything. What you want to do in these 7 days is to change them inside.
Mm-hmm.
That from within, they want to pray on time.
Mm-hmm.
That even when they go home, there's no reward, there's no punishment. They've still got this change within them that they want to pray on time. And so this happens through role modeling. This happens through teaching them the importance of things. This happens through making them enjoy it, making them enjoy, for example, sitting together and discussing intellectual discussion, asking questions and discussing and debating, reading a book, for example, praying, make prayers very attractive, make recitation of the Adhan, for example, very beautiful, make the Quran sessions very interesting.
Yeah.
These things actually make an internal change within them.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a big difference between discipline, where you want the camp to run very smoothly, everybody has recited their Quran, everybody has prayed on time, but this will not have any effect because after the course, when the rewards and punishment are gone, they're back to normal life, nothing has changed. You want to have an internal change. When they go back home, they actually will carry on doing the things that you want them to do. So very important to know how to give these changes, know how to make Islamic principles or Islamic rituals very, very attractive, very, very pleasurable, very, very amazing, basically.
Mm-hmm.
The best mentors, for example, are those who are able to create an amazement towards the Quran. That you want this child to go back home and says, one thing I learned from the course is how amazing this Quran is, right? Or, for example, to teach them about the importance of Salah and to make them enjoy Salah or to make them enjoy Dua, for example. Or simply to teach them how beautiful Islam is in terms of its impact on both the physical aspect and on the spiritual aspect. I learned that Islam encourages to do sport and to be clean and to shower every day and to make sure we're presentable. At the same time, Islam teaches us to pray and to fast and to give charity. So be very careful how we present Islam. There's a lot to say. Last point, I know time is running short, is if there's a lot of mentors together working together, it's very important that you're always on the same page, you don't contradict one another, that you're working very well in synchrony, and that the relationship that you're showing with one another, the respect that you're showing one another, is very crucial, because children look at that as well. They see your behavior with other mentors as well, and how you talk to them and what you say between each other, and this will have an impact on their own friend circle and how they behave between themselves as well.
So thank you so much, Brother Maghdad. In this program, we're talking about how we can be good mentor for children. So dear listeners, this was your host Hassan Ain, and thank you for joining us on the program. If you have any questions, comments or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. and visit us at our website, parstoday.com. And until another program, God bless you all.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Vietnam peace negotiations.
Part 1.
Choisy le roi. The handful of retired residents living on this quiet street, half an hour outside Paris, are intrigued. All eyes are riveted on one house, number 11. With the utmost discretion, behind closed shutters, two men meet face to face. Henry Kissinger, National Security Advisor to President Nixon, and Lê Duc Tho, Special Advisor to President Ho Chi Minh. From 1970 to 1973, far from Vietnam, the two men held secret negotiations in Choisy-le-Roi, Gives-sur-Yvette, and Saint-Nom-la-Bretèche in the suburbs of Paris. Still today, nobody is aware that hundreds of hours of their exchanges were recorded.
I thought yesterday we had reduced the issues on the text to only two. Now I find that there are 17. These substantive changes present the gravest difficulties for us in terms of good faith.
The two men are worlds apart, their culture, their ideology, their lives. They're at war. How will they make peace? A war that has lasted for over 10 years, led by the world's leading power against a small country populated mostly by poor farmers. In the face of U.S. relentlessness, Vietnam is putting up a determined resistance. Incapable of winning the war, each side wants to force its opponent to negotiate peace to its advantage. Any headway made in the negotiations is hindered by the pro-American regime of South Vietnam, which is struggling in the face of robust political and military opposition, but also by upcoming elections in the U.S., and more generally, by the fragile balance of East-West relations in the middle of the Cold War. The fate of an entire population hinges on these negotiations. Two years before the first meeting between Lê Duc Tho and Henry Kissinger, a new political force had started weighing in on the war, U.S. public opinion. But not solely U.S. public opinion, the whole world was demanding peace and the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Vietnam. By the end of March 1968, the military situation had deteriorated. The U.S. Army was in difficulty, and President Johnson decided to negotiate with North Vietnam. 2 months later, talks, which had begun in Paris between the North Vietnamese minister, Xuân Thủy, and the U.S. Ambassador Averill Harriman, rapidly proved inefficient. It took them 8 months just to decide who should sit around the negotiating table. Because in Vietnam, in the field, four armed forces are clashing with each other, split into two camps. North Vietnam, with its capital Hanoi, is a communist state run by Ho Chi Minh. The father of the struggle for independence in Vietnam, he had a separation imposed on his country, splitting the country in two as part of the 1954 Geneva Accords in the form of a demarcation line along the 17th parallel. Hanoi supports the opposition in South Vietnam. In the south, the anti-communist regime of Saigon is heavily supported by the U.S. Army. For the U.S., which claims to be the world's sheriff, the challenge is to contain the rise of communism, stopping it on the 17th parallel. Since Mao Zedong's arrival to power in China, followed by North Korea, then North Vietnam, the Americans fear a domino effect. What is the issue for Hanoi?
What we demand for is what Ho Chi Minh demand for. We demand for independence and freedom, and American withdrew, and Saigon regime must leave. And the Saigon regime want to insist it, that they are a nation. But Ho Chi Minh, no, we are one nation, one people.
By late 1968, during the official negotiations at Avenue Kléber in Paris, this strategy of containment has already proved very costly for the U.S. Demoralized GIs no longer believe in military victory over such a highly elusive enemy. From now on, for Washington, the objective is to get its troops out of the quagmire with its head held high. The other force around the negotiating table is the Saigon administration. At its head, General Nguyen Van Thieu, totally dependent on U.S. support. Thieu is concerned that the U.S. might abandon them on the altar of peace. He sets about attempting to sabotage the negotiations and, for the Americans, becomes a cumbersome partner.
We, South Vietnamese, did not want to oppose the talks, as we would have been accused of working against peace. But we told the Americans, who were starting talks with the North Vietnamese, that the future of Vietnam depended on the Vietnamese, not the Americans.
The final piece on the chessboard is the Fourth Military Force, the NLF, the National Front for the Liberation of South Vietnam. Nicknamed the Viet Cong by its opponents, it has formed its own political branch, the PRG, the Provisional Revolutionary Government, which is represented in Paris by Madame Nguyen Thi Binh. A resistant from the outset and a former political prisoner in Saigon, she is the voice of the armed resistance that controls part of South Vietnam and shares Hanoi's objectives to oblige the U.S. to leave Vietnam and to topple the Thieu regime.
We wanted what we called fighting while negotiating, a form of tactic. We had to fight on the three fronts, the military and political fronts, but also on the diplomatic front to try to strengthen our struggle.
As each party stands their ground, negotiations collapse.
Journalists referred to them as discussions among the deaf because of the way each party declared their position, which was then followed by a short exchange of criticism, and that was that. For three whole years, it was practically the same thing.
The new American president, Richard Nixon, then offered secret negotiations to Hanoi. On August 5, 1969, Henry Kissinger, Nixon's security advisor, and Xuân Thủy, a North Vietnamese minister, met in an apartment on the Rue de Rivoli in Paris. They were greeted there by Jean Saint-Denis, the former French delegate general in Hanoi. Secrecy. The cornerstone of the negotiations. For these diplomats of the shadows, secrecy gave them room to maneuver, to threaten, to bargain with, and to outwit their opponents, as well as to anticipate political and military issues. The closed doors loosened their tongues, as they were free from having to report to cumbersome partners. For as long as secrecy reigned, what was negotiated involved only themselves. Henry Kissinger and Le Doc Tu are skilled diplomats, well-versed in the art of playing chess against a racing clock.